Welcome to the Soft Focus podcast. I'm so happy you're here. My name is Corinne McAndrews, and I am a farmer and the founder of Late Bloomer Ranch. Several years ago, I started to notice that my farm thrived when I took a step back and started to embrace a more holistic worldview. I began to realize my farm was more than just transactions or dollar signs. It was a seemingly magical place with so much happening that I couldn't fully understand it. This led me to embrace complexity and begin to see the beauty in things even when they seem difficult. I started to understand the power of the idea that the whole is greater than the sum of its parts, and that by acting from a heart-centered place, we can accept the complexity of things and act in the best interest of the larger puzzle. I want to explore that and talk with other people across disciplines who are viewing the world that way and are looking for those very same connections, because that, I feel, provides peace, humility, and compassion, things that the world could use a lot more of today. I need to be constantly reminded of my important but small role in this bigger cycle. Thank you for being here and for joining me. Hi there. Welcome back to the podcast. I'm especially excited about today's episode with Mark Kimball of Essex Farm. I've admired Mark and his work, along with the work of his family, who all farm with him at Essex Farm in upstate New York, for years. Essex Farm is a whole diet, free choice, year-round CSA, meaning that their members can get their complete diet right there from their farm. Meat, eggs, vegetables, dairy, even some small grains. They work to raise those things in harmony in all of its chaos at their farm in upstate New York. I wanted to talk to Mark not only because of the beauty of Essex Farm, but also because of some of his thoughtful philosophical opinions about farming, our place in the world, whether we're doing it right, and how we even know that, and what it all means. Mark is very comfortable embracing questions, and he's not tempted to put a bow on things or to reduce complexity and make it more palatable. I felt like I could have talked to him for hours, and frankly, I was really nourished by the way that he was engaging with the questions and how much that inspired me to go deeper. It is hard to live in a world where sometimes up feels like down and left feels like right, and we don't know which way to go. But speaking with Mark, it helped me double down on my own core beliefs about why I farm, why I believe more people need to farm, even in all of its messy imperfection. It isn't about achieving Shangri-La or some kind of end destination. It's about experiencing all the messiness of it and learning and doing the best we can. There's inherent humility in this work from my perspective because I know I can never get it right, and learning to find the joy in that anyway and just try and be a little bit better today than I was yesterday. Just try and not make the same mistakes twice. And sometimes that still happens. In my experience, that happens a lot in life. My conversation with Mark reminded me of why I started this podcast, how nourishing it is to speak with people who are earnestly trying to align their life with their values, who are trying to make every day more or less correlate with what they believe and what they value, even though it often comes out in the wash or it doesn't come across the way that we want it to. There's just something in the pursuit of it all. So without any further ado, please enjoy Mark Kimball. We talk about why he farms, farming as an art form, some of his painful experiences trying to live up to his lofty ideals. We talk about where the rubber meets the road, where sometimes the quote-unquote right thing to do isn't evident, and how you take a step forward. And he shares so much wisdom about how he navigates it all and what his thoughts are for the future. Enjoy. Hi, Mark. Thanks for coming on the podcast.
It's my pleasure. It's a nice adjustment from being outside in the breezy, crazy weather we're getting up here in New York right now.
Yeah, November in New York. How did you come to farming a whole CSA diet farm?
I think the shortest answer is I was taking what other people considered a boring plant anatomy course in college that was focusing on adaptations of crop plants. and the professor gave us the opportunity on Saturday mornings to get up and visit farms independent of our final grade. And I credit that with the sort of aha moment of realizing that this is so fun to raise mushrooms in these giant wooden coffins in the middle of Pennsylvania, or hydroponic lettuce in southern New Jersey. We visited about a dozen different places, peaches, a couple animal farms. And I was just like, oh my gosh, I have to do this. So I switched my major from environmental science to farming. And that was in 1993. And I would say that if I have a vice since that moment on, I have really put more of my spirit into farming than just about anything else. Often to the chagrin of the people around me who are like, what are you doing? Why are you doing farming right now? I'm right here. So that's kind of how I got started.
And did you get started with one enterprise and just feel like you had to continue adding? Or was it always the vision from the beginning to have meat, eggs, vegetables, grains, dairy?
I am often critical, as is my nature, maybe from the way I was raised, but of others who look at farming first as, in the Northeast at least, as vegetable production. But I basically went down the exact same road. I was like, oh, I'm going to grow all my food because farming is about growing vegetables. And so through different apprenticeships, I think I slowly added different conceptions of what agriculture is. And now I try to remind myself every day that agriculture is everything that mining isn't, right? Like, so basically we have mining and agriculture, and that's where all of our sort of raw materials come from. So we've actually tried to explore what it would look like to do a firewood share, which we did for a couple seasons.
Wow.
Each time I think about farming, I think that integrating more different components on one farm, fiber, transportation, work, draft horses, the more integrated the landscape, I think the healthier it is for the humans and perhaps for the land as well. And so I think the evolution towards a full food diet still feels like the just very beginning of what a farm could be. But it came together working at different CSAs, the idea of a free choice table where if you had eggplant and peppers and squash, let's say zucchini, people could pick and choose if they weren't precious. And I think we moved towards a free choice diet here. I had already been farming, I guess, for 10 or 15 years. And when Kristen and I started here, we kind of spoke about wanting to create a CSA that let other people in our community, friends and family, eat the way farmers eat, which at its best would be you go out, you kill a chicken, eat it. So I think that was some of the genesis. There were other little factors along the way. But the more diversified I have farmed, the more complicated and crazy and happy I've felt.
Yeah, that's the rub, right? Ties into my next question for you. You've said that farming is just as much art as it is science, or maybe even more. And as I'm hearing you talk about the evolution from vegetables and even considering a firewood share, and so much of this adds more cogs in the machine. And how do you balance the beautiful art of it all with the practicality of needing to have a enterprise that's organized and functional?
We don't. I think the chaos is a really good training for being human, because the more we add to the complexity, I think, feel like we achieved something. And I think certainly my education was about going from point A to point B in a linear way. And it requires more of each of us on the farm. The whole team has to suddenly find something in them to say, all right, we're going to also do this today. All right, how do we do that? And I think one time we were asked why we farmed with horses and why we made it so difficult for ourselves by growing so many different things. And this isn't really exactly answering the question about art, but more adversity or challenge or hurdles, which is, I think the short answer for a lot of this is the reason we farm this way is because it's hard. And I think that's why people do a lot of different things. I don't think it's unique to this place. I think people have kids or get into relationships or take on something really difficult for themselves. And I don't think adversity is inherently the precursor to art, but I definitely think, sadly, that most great artists are deeply troubled, right? And so I think that it's that feel, that ability to feel hard feelings and then how you translate it, that I think lets us appreciate miraculous music or visual arts. And I think farming this way, I guess, made us into artists per se, but I like the idea that your expression of your own self in community could become a form of art. And again, I think that's a stretch for most people. They might call it a craft or an occupation, but it's certainly the reason that beautiful and terrible things happen here.
That resonates so deeply. I feel that art is trying to bring beauty and texture and physicality to an idea that maybe doesn't exist yet and or hasn't been articulated that way yet. And I feel that farming can be precisely that. It can be looking at the world and seeing so many disjointed, commodified bits of it and saying, can't we do better? Can't we have a deeper, more meaningful experience in these areas? Do we have to have these horrible pasteurized skim milk plastic bottles clogging up our waterways? Is that required? And to stretch beyond the business plan and complicate it more and more and more every day in pursuit of this perpetual motion machine, this utopia, I think maybe all farmers are a little bit crazy, or the ones that I know, I should say. I don't pretend to know all farmers. But yes, it is this pursuit of something perfect, even though I know I can't get there.
I love that. That sounds spot on and beautiful. And I think meets a lot of my needs as I try to describe what we do. I think striving feels like as good a result as anything. When people ask, I think we do some incredibly good things for people. I think we're more uncertain about how good what we're doing is for the planet. And when you were talking about uncertainty and that desire and shaping it into something, I talk about us being treading water, that Essex Farm hasn't solved anything, but we're treading water after some kind of a shipwreck, which you could call late capitalism or the industrial era. And I don't think that our fossil fuel use here is great, or I don't know how many roots are outweighing our overall carbon footprint. But if I were in the water with a bunch of people after a shipwreck, it would be kind of amazing to be able to tread water, and you would be able to still breathe, and maybe there'd be some resources to share. And when I look at all of the farmers that have come through here, and including myself and my family, I'm like, oh, I'm kind of glad I get to tread water. It's a little bit better than swimming off into the sharks by yourself to an unknown horizon that has no land. And so right now we're kind of holding on to some flotsam and hopefully sharing some resources. And I think waiting and also searching at the same time for which direction to go. And that's felt like I don't know if the analogy is ever helpful, but sometimes I think about that when I'm a little despondent about the downsides of some of the stuff we do here, or the lack of clarity that I feel, or the lack of certainty, maybe.
I'd love to dig into that more. I think you've been farming for decades. We had this huge resurgence in the 21st century of interest in organic farming, young people feeling a lot of chutzpah to get out there and try. We have these high, lofty ideals, these ideas of regenerative agriculture, that we're leaving the land better than we found it, that we have a net positive impact. And yet, I'm with you. I also, you know, just this morning, we're talking about how we're going to stack our hay for winter, and are we going to use single-use plastic to prevent the hay from getting wet, right? Because I don't have a hay barn. We have some great canvas tarps, but even they have some chemicals on them that prevent, that help the water run off. There's just these trade-offs that I'm confronted with daily that are imperfect. And I would love to hear, if you were taking the temperature today, all this aspirational interest in farming, you know, are new farms making it? Are we improving? How has this arc changed since you've been in the game?
I love it. I love it. That's the answer in a way, which is to hold the question. And I think we all know that to give an answer to a question like that sometimes diminishes that holding of something uncertain. So that's my first response, which is, I think being able to phrase a question of complexity and heartfelt concern and love is probably more in line with the art of Essex Farm and me than answering it. So with that caveat, I find myself triggered when I hear people use the word regenerative. It drives me nuts, right? This idea of saying we're already good and we've already proven to ourselves that we are making it better than it was and it will get better in the future, without data, without research, with hope, doesn't feel healthy to me. Especially because I have my doubts, right? If I was like, oh no, this is all great, buying in a couple thousand gallons of diesel and the canvas tarps you mentioned. If I was like, oh, this is good, if Forever Chemicals, I was like, this is great. Maybe there would be that certainty that born again evangelical energy. Like, this is it. And I have no ability to, right? I don't believe that. I think membership farms like this are amazing. And I love what it does to people, myself, the farmers, the community. But there are studies that talk about people driving in rural areas to 5 or 6 farms to get their food and how the fossil fuel footprint is so much bigger with that than just going to around here, a Hannaford's or a Price Chopper or whatever it is. But I don't think that makes the question of what would we do were we to head towards regenerative less important. I think that's a beautiful thing to hold. And I guess it makes me think a lot of how we support each other. And it brings me back to our sort of formal education system, how nowadays it seems like if you go to a fancy private school like I went to for high school and college, a B plus is sort of a failing grade, right? You're just like an A to B minus, you're out. But we sort of move the whole equation to the very top of what used to be, I presume, a 100-point scale. Listening to my mom in college, it was a bell curve and 30% of the people failed. And I wonder if I'm able to care about you and other people and still also tell you that that's not working or what you're doing is not the right way to do it, or I don't know how to put the words in it, but how do you tell someone? I use for myself a negative 10, positive 10 kind of graphic equalizer of how are we doing, because I'm willing to go for a run and I'm not an Olympic runner.
Right.
And I still love moving my body. And so can we suspend the judgment part for the assessment to help us lead each other towards regenerative, I think is what I'm asking, right? So let's say Essex Farm, I would give us probably a negative 9 on a regenerative scale, but that's so much better than negative 10. And that doesn't make me depressed. That's like, cool. And maybe in my lifetime, we'll get to negative 8. But the idea of not greenwashing is so anathema to selling anything. If I told you, hey, I've got something really terrible that probably did some damage to multiple facets of our ecosystem, and it's the best I can do, good morning, here it is, right? So I struggle with that kind of complexity, right? People want to feel nurtured and cared for. They want to know that they're buying something, in our case, as members, with it, that is whole and healthy. I can't fairly say that we are regenerative or sustainable. I think those words are really big and mean either we're keeping ecosystem services as they are, or we're actually definitively making them better. What I can say is taste this, eat this, and then they come back to me and they say, why do I feel so different, right? So while I think on the sort of environmental impact of small, quote, sustainable or, quote, unsustainable farms, there just needs to be a whole lot more interest in figuring out what they're made of on a nutrient, water, air set of metrics. What I do see is that taking away as much of the industrial paradigm from farming as possible provides a food supply that members talk about, as I was sort of alluding to earlier, almost as if it was an evangelical transformation, right? That drinking raw milk, eating grass-fed meats, consuming vegetables that are part of 10-year rotation, I'd say once or twice a week, someone just reaches out and says, I can't believe I get to be part of this, or I can't believe that this felt so nourishing. What did you do to the radicchios taste really good? It seems like a high content of whatever we like about potatoes and the potatoes this year. My daughter enjoyed this summer's milk more than usual because we have fewer, quote, weeds and more of the legumes mix as we've grazed more. So the feedback from people consuming the products that we produce is really beautiful and so needed, because the quagmire of what we were talking about earlier, of who are we, how do we interact, and how do we measure our impact, also requires that thing we call love, right? For me to tell you something that might be considered harsh, I think psychology says I need to say 6 nice things about how this podcast is going for you to be able to receive, right? Which is, hey, I think we should turn down the volume, right? You're not going to be receptive. So there's the receptive part, there's the psychology part, but then there's a sort of scientific metrics that I think are so forgotten among people who feel overwhelmed by the consolidation of the planetary forces of business. To be blunt, I think that I feel that. I feel overwhelmed at how quick big farms have gotten bigger in our neighborhood. We live in a really deprived agricultural county, and the county to the north, the dairy cow herds were 1,000 cows when we got here 20 years ago, and they're now pushing, I think, 12 or 13,000 cows. So these changes are happening in one person's lifetime where you don't recognize the agriculture. It's growing so quickly. And then you have these little farms like ours that are sometimes getting smaller, like we have in the last couple of years, and feeling healthier. And you just, I don't always have the ability to reconcile the multifaceted complexities. And I remember people talking about President Obama as someone who trusted us to be able to look at sort of two opposite truths and try to hold them. And we can talk about that in terms of war right now. What are the different truths at different warring countries? And farming to me is infinite truths, a lot of them competing against each other. And it's like, sometimes it feels like I can't swim, going back to the treading water, that I'm sinking. And I'm like, oh.
Well, first of all, I think giving yourself a -9 is too harsh. You're out there, you are grazing animals on the landscape, you're watching and you're responding. Even that, I feel like there are farms that watch and respond to what's happening. And then there are farms that push the agenda. And even just by really working with animals on the landscape, whatever, wherever that finds you, and trying to meet their needs and graze them and have a responsive posture, I think you should be a little bit kinder to yourself, because that is already so different from the way most farms operate, just from a philosophical standpoint. But beyond that little clerical matters that our listeners realize who you are and what you're attempting to do, when I think about this problem, I just think about my daughter. I don't have any guarantee that she'll be looking at me when she's 40 years old and say, yeah, mom, you did it right. For all I know, she could be looking at me and saying, mom, look what you did. But I still need to go out and do it. And it's a daily investigation of what do I believe, without becoming attached that that's the right thing. And that is a hard posture for me to hold. I'm naturally very opinionated. I can tend towards stubbornness and even pigheadishness. You brought up the current state of world affairs. Don't I love to think that I know exactly what our foreign policy should be? Oh yeah, I'd love to think that I have the answers. But really, I'm just one person. And I do believe in my heart that at this moment in time, we need more small farms run by real people who are really imperfect, who may not agree with me about everything, and that we all need to have the humanness to just try, even if we fail. Because losing small farms, losing farmland, my county's mostly hay production, and we go through a lot of hay. We love hay, nothing against hay, but it's not food that humans eat. We need to be thinking about, and as you said, it's also, you know, it's fiber, it's firewood, it's building materials. Agriculture is so much. And if we are not building up robust small farms that are sort of living petri dishes for our aspirations about what is a new agriculture and what is regenerative agriculture, we won't get anywhere. So we just need to, I think, work together and have some humility that maybe what I'm doing isn't exactly right, but by doing it, I have a much better shot of getting close to what's air quotes right.
Beautiful. That makes me think I got to read Shaw of Shaws by Kapuscinski. I don't know how to pronounce that name. He was writing, and I was reading it last night, about how revolutions start. And I don't know, I haven't studied revolution beyond sort of books like Shaw of Shaws, which are amazingly poetic historical reflections. And we don't know exactly when the revolution starts. We can't predict, rather, we know when it starts, but we don't know before it starts when it will start. And going back to the treading water, my hope is that of the hundreds of farmers that visit here, that farm here, all of us, that someone will swim in the right direction and say, oh, there's land, right? And I think that desire, I think it's John Berger who wrote Pig Earth, talks about the peasant hope that we gloss over the hardships of the past and we always see a brighter future despite the misery of the present. And I don't live that way, but this idea that unless we hold place, which sounds much more modern than my sort of training, for the unknown and for that vulnerable future, then it all becomes whatever the commodification of the planet is, right? The hay in your backyard is no longer a multifaceted ecological integration of our needs with the bigger place. And so I do like to think, whether it's Greta Thunberg or whoever it is at the moment, that there will be in the small, weird farming community, someone that starts swimming away from the rest of us, because we know we're drowning. It's such a hard, suffocating feeling to not quite be able to keep your head above water. And the consequences are what we're seeing, which is nearby farms around here are now going out of business. And the idea that you have to walk through the paces, that their action and responsible action are so important, but also keeping that prayer that one of us, there's no famous farmer in the planet, right? There's nobody. In the hippie circles, sure, we know the Salatins, we know the Fukuokas, we know the Rodales, whoever mm-hmm. it is. There are some names that in a very small subset of a very few people are like, oh, they're famous. And then you ask a person on the street, maybe they even did read Paulin's book, and they don't remember Salatin or they don't remember anybody. There's nobody out there who's talking to us about a land ethic the way Aldo Leopold wrote. You know, you have a few environmentalists that fly around and remind us that flying around isn't ideal. But in farming, there is this incredible vacuum that was created because independent communities are anathema to a global economy and to a global politic. And so looking back, if you want to feel really sad about how the ship got wrecked in the first place, there were crimes committed that were not human stupidity leading to something we didn't know. They were overt, let's centralize this because we want to make more money. And the greed, if you look historically in agriculture and the sort of focus on this, let's make one crop that grows best here, is so destructive to the graphic equalizer of plus 10, minus 10, and to the soul and to all of our communities. And I think having traveled widely as a kid, especially in the developing world, and looking at agriculture fiercely and quietly at times, a whole community would switch to growing coffee and then a disease would come in and they would have bankrupt themselves because they would no longer have had their livestock or their existing crops. And I got to see that firsthand, where you would see poverty because of centralization and global systems. And I don't think this farm is a direct response or a solution to that, but it is, again, I think this idea of, if nobody's doing this, where are we?
I'd love to hear more about your land ethic, what that means to you, and how you interact with that on a daily basis, that moment when you're assessing, hey, this is an imperfect system. Does it align with what I'm trying to achieve? How do you know if it's the best you can do? I heard you mention that you look a lot towards your members and their response, their physical response to the nutrient-dense food that you produce, obviously with all your animals and soils working as a unit. When you're investigating this land ethic, which is lofty and, yeah, I'll say it, unrealistic, right? And that's what motivates us. I'm okay with that. I'm okay that my standards are completely unrealistic. That's what keeps me going. But I also then have these moments on the daily where the rubber hits the road and I think, am I going to administer antibiotics to this feeder pig, or am I going to quickly dispatch this suffering animal with all the love and care in my heart? That's where the land ethic, the philosophizing gets grounded. So can you tell me about how you work through that and what's happening in your farm today where you're living out this process?
Again, I think the way you were able to shape that as an inquiry makes me cry. That's what I need to do every day. You know, I'm weeping now. Ask the question and let yourself cry, because there isn't an answer, right? It takes my breath away to hear those words, because that's what I live every day. And the certainty that when I put 20 gallons of diesel in the John Deere 5500 yesterday to spread compost, root hairs, root exudates, sure, there is some carbon being pulled out of the air, but I sure know that when the diesel goes up in the air, it's what we thought about water quality 50 years ago, right? We need to preserve the water. We just don't see it going up. We let it go. It's how all of our American walled communities prevent people from entering. There's so many issues that, because we don't see them, we're not present with the wholeness of the world. And so in terms of how do I take the impossible idealism and try and fail to bring it into a personal way, I think it was 3 weeks ago, the compost that I'm spreading right now, I was turning it with a skid steer. And I asked myself why I couldn't practice meditative breathing while skid steering. And this may seem like a funny answer to your question, but usually my answer to how do you farm better is to ask yourself, what do you need to do to be healthy? Because I want to be around you when you're healthy.
Mm-hmm.
I want to nourish you when you're sick and help you feel whole. But I also want to be inspired by you. When you're at your full game on, the question you just asked that made me cry, that's what I want to be around. And if I'm not presenting that to the rest of the world, then I want to ask myself, what do I need to do to be at peace so that the beginning of the treading water becomes a swimming to shore?
Mm.
And I do a daily practice, 2, 3, now maybe 10 times a day where someone said, breathe in 4, hold 7, breathe out 8. I learned years ago. I have lots of different breathing that I do, high stress, low stress. And I started doing it while I was doing the very repetitive and yet heterogeneous activity of 2 handles, 2 pedals, lifting compost, dumping it, turning it. And I started this breathing practice while I was turning compost. And of course, I bumped the skid steer into the concrete wall and I like carried too much and started tipping forward, but I got the hang of it.
Mm.
And I started to get into a flow state that wasn't me solving the question of transcendence. It was me being myself in that moment and integrating something that I know is not good for the planet. Large-scale John Deere skid steer using refined diesel. Highly processed might be my one word for everything that's not good for us, right? The higher the processing, whether it's in the screen or the communication we're using now versus in, right? If it's highly processed, we kind of look back and we're like, oh, gunpowder, highly processed, not so good. So I'm in this highly processed environment. I'm in a highly processed concrete barn, highly processed compost, going to myself, this is living hell. It's not good on your body. It's loud. I've got my earplugs in and I'm starting to breathe. And that is one answer to what you asked of how do I make the decisions I do, which is usually, oh, I have a stress about this. I don't know what to do. Start to breathe. And I think the hardest part for me as a sort of iconoclastic, arrogant white dude in his 51st year is to remember that over and over people remind us in so many different ways that reaching out to other people in an open and loving way may be the biggest benefit to us that there is. They're now saying that meaningful friendships may be more meaningful than organic food.
Mm-hmm.
But the idea of connecting to people, which these screens are preventing, right? You and I are filtered by so many billions of dollars to create us that we will maybe never see each other. We have this connection, but it's through a highly processed medium. The idea of creating the most meaningful relationships may be how we start to love a cockle burr that's growing in a weird place on our farm, right? That it's not a weed. It's a miracle that we're related to evolutionarily, that for whatever reason, like you were talking about choosing to slaughter an animal that's injured, everything we do on this farm is about sex and death, right? We're doing all this reproduction and then we're killing the cabbage plant before it's had a chance to put out its inflorescence. And you use a word like inflorescence and tell me the cabbage is magic. And cabbage, when it splits open on the top and throws this 6-foot stalk in the air and makes seeds, is why we're alive. If it didn't do that, we're dead. It's so cool.
Yes.
And we glibly just go through wholesale killing stuff because, like, well, we need the cabbage and we need to think about. So maybe a way to say it is that I'm hopeful that creating myself, I'm not even in control of myself, to be honest, right? Like, that's the issue. If we were, we wouldn't be having these conversations. We'd be like, it would be perfect. And so learning to be with myself, but then at the same time with imperfection, walking towards the people around me, figuring out how to make space for family, for friends and members, feels like one of the answers to the question of what do we do with this land, because they are not separate. And I try to remind myself all the time of oneness. And that sounds a little more meditative to live, but we are not opposite nature or somehow different from nature in my feelings. We are one with nature. We may choose to think of ourselves in a concrete, brick, steel city as separate from nature. That's a choice. I believe in the scientists that say that there are such things as atoms and that these atoms in me were somewhere else 200 years ago. That's enough to be a touchstone to say good morning.
Mm.
And that's what I think we're trying to do here is to allow ourselves to greet what we're facing, to say good morning, and to somehow spread that cool feeling amidst the hardship of I am here And then suddenly skid steering the compost and figuring out how to breathe and bumping into the wall comes a new way of perceiving what's going on.
I just love what you're saying. This is something I think about incessantly almost, is how can I expect the world to be one way if I am not that way? It has to start with me. Who am I to go out into the world and want to move everything around because it's not to my liking? I really hear what you're saying, Mark. I have a very supportive spouse, but he's not a farmer, which actually has a lot of benefits. But our farm is not the traditional romantic family farm. I have to go out and make room for my authentic true nature, as well as the authentic true nature of my employees, who are really more like team members. We do a lot of things by committee. That's just naturally how I'm wired. It's not that I think that that's some lofty ambition. It's just easier for me to operate that way. But by thinking, I can't expect our farm to be some perfect ideal if I am not carrying peace and calm and equanimity and acceptance in my heart. And when I was listening to you explain your story in the skid steer about bumping into the concrete wall, I was just reminded of that famous Zen koan about chopping wood and carrying water. And that often the answer to my problems is just doing what needs to be done and being fully in that, even if it's not pleasurable. It's not just about that. And maybe through that experience with the skid steer, in 2 or 3 years, you'll do things differently, or there will be some progress or change, but also maybe not. I mean, maybe that's also just what we are doing now. And by allowing myself to be in my work, whatever that looks like, I'm making room for all the animals on my farm, the quote-unquote weeds that you talked about earlier. My relationship to these beings here changes profoundly when I'm at peace with myself, however imperfect and flawed and messy and crazy. So I wanted to ask you from that point, because sometimes I feel like farming exists in my marriage, it exists in my parenting, because as above, so below. Do you notice when you are really in flow with this pursuit of a perfect agriculture, this pursuit of your land ethic, do you see that show up in your relationships and outside of your farm and with your community?
I don't know. Yes and no. There's so many complexities to how we get along and how I get along with people. Someone told me the other day that people either love me or hate me. And it's not that fun to reflect on that. I have other things I want to do besides think about why that might be. And I like thinking of Marcus Aurelius when you feel overwhelmed by the opinions of others, because stoically go into your own space and just do what you think is right, which doesn't feel accurate. And I think a couple things have happened in the last few years that have started to change me. We have offered for years, anyone who wants land, it's out there, right? It's just a conversation with whoever is the quote landowner, right? Mm-hmm. So we have a typical acre right now that neighbors who wanted to double dig a garden have stewarded for the last 2 years. And everyone who walks by is like, oh, this is so cool. We have a every other week meditation from a neighbor who's a psychology professor at SUNY Plattsburgh, who offers us around a fire at the farm here a chance to just sit quietly and contemplate some of what we're talking about in a meditative way. And those two things come to mind, along with a third in answer to your question of how do we relate to people, is that as we become more certain that we're doing something right, I'm spreading lots of compost today. As soon as we're done, we're going to eat lunch as a team, and then I'm going to go out and spread another 10 loads of compost that has all these virtues. But it has been 15 years since I filled up spreaders by hand. We'd filled up our spreaders by hand our first couple years. So one answer is to remember to walk when you have a car, to remember to fork the compost by hand when you have a tool to do it. And I think applying a similar philosophy, for lack of a better word, to your human interactions at the same time. You may be really good at, I'm better with adults than kids. That's a bullshit sentence. Like, I started farming, I stopped really being the kind of cool teacher that kids would be attracted to, because I'm like focused on you. And how do we move those porta huts we talked about before the podcast around the farm in a way that's ethical? And I really got focused and, wait, am I open to a childlike energy, even in my life? Can we start moving scale and tools, both the physical kind, but also the emotional kind? So what does it feel like to die is something that's fun to contemplate in meditation, because it's really hard and the opposite of fun. I don't think I've really thought so much about what's it like to be a baby again. Actually a baby, not an old person drooling. The idea of moving through the different possibilities we have with each other. And in a more direct answer to sort of how am I getting along with people, there's so many facets to that. And I think you're talking about marriage could be a whole podcast, because who we sleep with and how we farm are, in my mind, so often more connected than we really want to talk about.
Yes.
But moving away from marriage, unless we want to go there, thinking about farmers here, it seems as though, since we're no longer a first decade farm, that people stay here a little bit longer than they used to. Most of the people have now been here a few years, some 9, some 5, some 15. So there's a little more of a stable essence in our team. I wouldn't say that the bonds that we have are necessarily stronger or more wholesome, although I think that may be there. But there is something about doing the different routines we do in life with the same people over time that might be described as depth versus breadth. I think part of what we're talking about here, maybe, and again, the words aren't poetic enough for me to feel happy with them, but the idea of going a little deeper with who we are within context feels really healthy. And it's why I think I've said to myself, honestly, and that may change tomorrow, I don't need to ever leave this community.
Mm-hmm.
People around are like, I need to go travel. I got to do so much exploration when my 0 to 30s that I don't need much to feel full. And I think that fullness, because of who I am, sometimes comes across for the people that might be in the camp of, he drives me nuts, as too much. I'm on send as opposed to receive. And so, you know, my coaching to myself is something on the order of shut up and listen.
I mean, it's all about that giving and receiving. I love this time of year. I love mucky November. I love watching death roll over the valley and wait for the deep rest of winter, because it's not about, to me, choosing which parts of life we like and which parts of life are just frankly inconvenient. It goes back to that concept of who am I to go out into the world and say, move that to the left, get rid of those people. I don't like that person's creative idea. No, I really don't believe that that's why I was born on this planet. But to be able to root into where I am, this idea that you expressed about depth versus breadth. I was having this exact same conversation last night. It could be because I'm pregnant again. It could be because I have a farm and I have a small child, but I just want to root in. I want to root into this place. I want to root into my relationships, however imperfect. And people who know me personally will probably roll their eyes, but I always think about the expression, the way you do anything is the way you do everything. And what an invitation that is, to actually let go, reconnect with the humanness and the imperfection of it all, because actually I can change everything to the fullest extent that's even possible for me by just changing this one thing and by creating that sense of rooting. And I completely resonate with what you're saying, Mark, just that being one place is enough. And as we've industrialized agriculture, we've pushed ourselves as humans to places that we never would have been able to exist before. Is that a good thing or a bad thing? That's above my pay grade, but I can definitely say something is lost. Wendell Berry wrote about this, you know, just when we're constantly using innovations and technologies to push beyond what a landscape will hold or what a draft horse will pull or what a mere mortal can accomplish in one day. What is lost there? And I think it's some of this depth versus breadth that you're discussing, because I could go buy a kiwi right now, but what am I really doing? Why am I so resistant to just roasting a few more turnips and making use of those lamb riblets? And why do I feel like I need to bring in this essence from halfway across the world to change or modify who I am? And it's just become so commonplace in our culture, I don't even think we question it anymore.
I think that pulls us into a circle, at least for this conversation in some ways, which is, as you're speaking, I'm flooded by the role of the artist in a community. And I think usually an artist is not seen as a productive member of society. And the idea that weird farms are not productive. We are not. Our cows are probably at once a day milking, producing 20 pounds, 25 pounds of Jersey milk every day, not 50, not Holstein 65.
Right.
The idea of art being the response, the healthy invitation to your community to see things differently at its best feels so healthy to me and feels like the reason, maybe if we were all really rooted, then you need to send somebody walking to see whether there is a river on the other side of them, there are hills, right? When you're just in one insular place, then the artist goes out and has a dream on a mountain and comes back with a Bible, right? When the whole community is now in a spread out, untouched breadth of sort of superficiality. And now I sound like a crank, but it does seem like the role of those of us who are able to be still with ourselves. That's not me, by the way. People are like, you're so just moving all the time. But the idea of searching for that becomes the reason why I think using the word art is maybe a way to describe what we're talking about. And then I think Kristen, I think it was in her first book, she wrote that in this discussion of farmers as artists, this is the crux of it. And you talked about it with leading your team on the farm and not being married to a farmer, is community art usually looks and feels bad. There aren't too many times where I've seen, oh, these three artists painted it. Like I did some of that in college. I did a lot of art. And when you have three people paint it, looks hell. And so, like it does. You put three kids, you put one kid together, you give him crayons, you take it away at the right time, and it's genius. You put three kids together, and it's sort of like this lowest common denominator where it becomes a mess. And so this is the question that Kristen and I, in our marriage and in our community, are asking ourselves. We want to be a farmer-owned cooperative here badly. The number of role models that do that in this way, not just a milk co-op or a grain co-op that owns, is zero. And why is that? We're not profitable enough for anyone to want to share in our zero-sum game. Okay, sure. But we are in terms of our soil fertility. Anyway, I think there's a million ways to go with this, but it just is so interesting to talk about rooting in as the artistic response to where rich white Americans are right now, right?
Yeah. I mean, it leads to my last question for you, even though I could talk to you for the next 8 hours if there wasn't compost to be spread. But are you optimistic? I think despite our imperfections and some of the greenwashing and the tendency for people to want to wipe their hands of any responsibility by calling things sustainable or regenerative or whatever, despite all of that, despite all the failing farms and the farms becoming subdivisions, I think at my core, I'm optimistic about where agriculture is going. And maybe that's my personal form of mental illness. But I'd like to pose that question to you. Are you, in your heart, optimistic about where agriculture is going?
No. It's such an easy answer. But to answer a different question, I think, you know, what came to mind when you started asking the question was I've been reading about the Burgess Shale, where there were all these little arthropods, and there were like 12 different body types. And when Stephen Jay Gould started revisiting the Burgess Shale, which was this explosion of life, it was the first sort of fossil record of multicellular life, his conclusion, and it was partly wrong, we don't know exactly what we're talking about ever. In 500 years, our conversation is going to look so pitiful. I know that. But Gould's takeaway was, we are not a cone of increasing complexity towards you and me talking through one of the most complicated tools ever made on planet Earth, besides planet Earth. We are not this like definitive, oh, it will get smarter. His point is all of those forms of arthropod life that look so scary that they make any horror film you've ever seen look like a pitiful expression of human creativity. These are nutso. You look at Opabinia, you look at Hallucigenia, you look at Sydnea, these three different organisms of 20, and you're like, I can't believe that existed. You know, they're 2 centimeters to a foot long. But his take was, we are here, but for the grace of evolution, we would not be here. Because if any of those others had happenstance made it, there wasn't a competitive reason for one to make it or one not to. We can't find that. His point is, these were all structures that could have led to a very different future. I use that in two ways. One, to remind myself that farming is going to get worse in my whole lifetime and will continue to. And it is hopelessly sad that I will not get to see that change. I also am seeing that. I realize that in the five extinction periods, we will be one of those extinctions at some point. So there's like sort of, it's no and no. Yes, agriculture will get worse. Yes, we will go extinct. But your question about optimism on a broader scale is, can we, any of us, you, me, the baby kid, the plant, have a touchstone as often as possible that reminds us to be here? And so I think what farming has given me more than anything is the idea that we don't just need a rosary, we don't just need our meditation, that we can find that ability to love with almost any stimulus that we allow ourselves. And the idea of, I'm looking around this room of a house that has so many faults and a person that has faults, and presuming you also have some faults, and to find that touchstone in every moment or at every stimulus. So if a brain thought comes in, using that brain thought or using the tactile feeling of your own fingerprint on your two thumbs rubbing together, or sitting in a skid steer or treading water, because I like to swim in cold water, what can we use for touchstones that give us the opening to some of the beautiful questions you asked today and some of the incredible successes that being in touch with this little piece of ground here on Essex Farm have given me? So I think that's my optimism, is that as I move quickly towards death, I'm 51, dude. I think I'm finding in that pursuit of art and perhaps death, again, two words that I don't exactly abide by, the idea that there are more touchstones, even looking at you at a screen, holding onto your microphone. I don't know you. I don't know what we just did, but the idea that this can help be here as me, and then, oh, if someone else is doing that, maybe they could be there. And right. So there is this idea of becoming ourselves in context.
Yes.
That I think is so beautifully hopeful and powerful, or whatever those words we use for easy, good feelings as opposed to hard, difficult feelings.
Yes. I'm just reminded that even if I didn't have my borderline impractical level of optimism, in some ways it doesn't matter because I'm still here, right? In some ways it doesn't matter if the future is going to get brighter because I'm still here. It doesn't really matter if I think that meeting you over Zencastr is an imperfect medium because it's the one that I have. And I am grateful for it. And I've spoken on this podcast before about my kind of tenuous relationship with technology, where I need it and I love it and I use it to grow my business, but also I resent it and I wish it wasn't so. And I wish I could grow my business exactly the way that I want to. And at the end of the day, all that is secondary, and I should probably just get in the skid steer and move the compost or turn the compost, and I'm going to hit maybe a concrete wall or get a little nauseous from the incessant vibrations. And it's just up to me to let that be enough, I think. And my farm's not perfect today. Maybe yours is, I'm not sure, but my farm isn't. And to just let that, to let the pursuit of this crazy, wild, maybe useless life be enough. That's where I am today.
That's exactly right. And I think as you're saying that, the difference that we can make is using the tools that you just put forth. And when we feel like we are ourselves at that moment, and maybe not before that moment, then we can be, again, another word that I don't understand, then we can be brave and courageous.
Mm-hmm.
So then we can step out of the skid steer and say, I want to bring draft horses back to Essex Farm, which makes me cry. That only through health and being present and going through these motions can we then stop, drop, and open up to being brave enough to make the changes that we really do need to not be turning compost with a skid steer. Right? Because I don't believe that anyone looking back in 1,000 years will say, oh, that was a really good choice. I think it's not okay to say, this is not good farming. I know that this farm here is not good farming. I tell people who are members, can you imagine if there were 20 million farms like this, how pitiful we would look? Because if there were 20 million farms, we would all be learning from each other at a level that this is the very beginning.
Yeah.
This is the one atom in a universe. This is not the solution. I know that in my deepest heart. And am I brave enough to step out of the skid steer and pick up a pitchfork and even do 5 shovelfuls into the spreader at the end of the day? So I feel like, I don't know that we went anywhere with this, but the idea that it's words, and the practice is where it hits the road. But is it right to think that if we become whole and loving and vulnerable, we can then stretch beyond our comfort zone, which is, I think, what we're talking about. And that when you go beyond comfort, I think everyone else looks at you and says, you are brave as an athlete, as an artist, as an adventurer, as an explorer. A lot of those words are a little more weighted than they should be, or maybe they should be more weighted than I used. But that idea that with community and love, a few of us can cry our way out to shovel manure into a spreader.
I chuckled when you asked if we went anywhere, because I think, where can we even go, right? We're rooting into right here. And that's the paradox, the seeming paradox. It's not paradoxical at all when I live it. It is so true that all I have is the problem that's in front of me right now. And that if I root into it and I embody it and I become it, I have much better luck at quote unquote solving it. But that's why I chuckled, because to put it on paper, it looks like nothing. And yet to live it, it's everything. And it's so meaty and rich. So I know people listening will want to find Mark Kimball after this conversation. You mentioned your wife and some of her amazing writings. Where can people connect with Essex Farm, what you're doing, your musings and your thoughts in the world?
That's a sweet question. And I get teased for inviting everybody to this farm. And I'll do that here as well, because there's nobody here. In most of our fields, you can see no dwelling of any sort. In all of our fields, you can only see the 10 of us that farm here on a day when we happen to be in the same field. So everyone is invited. We're in Essex, New York. Ask for Essex Farm. And maybe even more than coming to see me and Kristen, who are such a small fraction of what has created this farm on every level, it's all the people in the whole community and all the farmers that have come through. But the invitation is for people to taste some of the food we're growing. Again, pitiful, diversified, organic, free choice membership food. And yet, when people start eating this food, it brings me joy to see their joy, right? So come here, eat some food, walk this land, see what you can see. Build a house here. We're trying to figure out, there's 3,000 acres for sale around us right now. No one wants to live here. And we're in a beautiful place with plenty of rainfall and good soils, right? Nobody wants to be outside or farming. So the invitation, a much broader answer, is get yourself up to Northern New York and see what you are made of with us. And then on a very like teeny level, the high-tech tool we're using now, my text number is 518-570-6399. And people are like, you and Kristen are so famous. I'm like, yes. Once a year, someone asks me if the farm store is open. That's how famous we are. Literally, that's the only unsolicited text. And it might be once every 18 months. So please reach out. And then I go in and out of using Instagram under the handle Farmer Kimball. And I have made good connections via that medium a couple times, but they're not in person. And then Kristen's books are the poetry that we're dancing with here today. And I read them and I pick them up and I can't believe what she does with words. And the blood, sweat, and tears that you and I put into our farming, she puts into her writing, literally, like hair pulling. It's so hard to write poetry. She somehow knows that. But her books are The Dirty Life and Good Husbandry. And of the two, the better is Good Husbandry, but it's a lot more like our conversation today, which is people read it and they're like, oh, it's not as uplifting and invitational. I'm like, no, it's not.
Yeah, Good Husbandry is messy. Spoiler alert. It's not so allegorical, is it?
No. And I think it was reviewed, right, at the reviewers, people, and it sold no copies. And the other one paid for half of our farm, right? So the second book took the upswelling of The Dirty Life, which was one of the touchstones for young farmers who were getting into farming. And then Good Husbandry slammed the door. But the door slam is what we learn from.
Yeah. Well, I can't thank you enough, Mark. This has been such a deeply enriching conversation for me. And I am so grateful to be able to connect with you, with your experience and your wisdom and your raw honesty and your unique genius. So thank you so much for joining me today.
I don't think I've ever cried in a podcast before, ever. So, so much. Let's be in touch. I hope we get to see what our various forages look like at some point in the future.
Yeah, I'd love that. Thank you so much. Take care.
Thank you so much for joining me today. I really hope you enjoyed this episode. Please reach out with any comments or with other guests you'd like to hear. You can find us at latebloomerranch.com or on Instagram at latebloomerranch. You can also drop me an email at hello@latebloomerranch.com. I'd love to hear from you. See you next time.